Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. Today I want to talk about Zen Master Hakuin and his Song of Zazen, which is a very famous poem. Jim has been working on our new chant book here, and we have a number of pages. Hopefully sometime soon in the new year we'll have that, and the Song of Zazen will be part of this chant book, and we will chant it more often than we do now. It's a really nice text. I'm not even going to read the text today. I'm just going to talk about the first four lines of this text. And I'm going to do that to explain a fundamental principle in Zen. But before I do that, I want to say something about Hakuin. With talks like this, one thing is to talk about Buddhism, of course, but also it's to tell stories, and so that you learn some of these Zen stories about these Zen people and their stories, their lives. So Hakuin lived about 300 years ago in Japan, born in 1686 and died in 1768. When he died, he was the most respected Zen master in Japan, and he was the most respected Zen master of his era in Japan. He revitalized what was had become a stagnant Rinzai Zen. And he walked to the beat of his own drum. He did things his own way. For instance, he wrote his own autobiography, something that nobody ever did in those days. They waited for the next generation to write the biography of the master. And he was a big, somewhat rule-breaking character. He wrote a lot of things, wrote poems that were wild in a meter that nobody had ever done before, painted almost comical paintings. I should have brought one of those. Wes, how would you describe a Hakuin painting?
Energetic.
Energetic, yeah, exactly. And free, I would say. Sometimes he's humble, often he's braggadocious. And as a child, he ran hot. In his autobiography, he explains a kind of a well-known story now where when he was 11 years old, he heard a traveling preacher, Nichiren, from the Nichiren school of Buddhism, talk about the eight hot hells. And this freaked him out. As you can imagine, a kind of circuit preacher today, talking about something like this. This really worried him. And then that night, his mother was giving him a bath. You know, Japanese baths are hot. And he would not get in the bath. And it really just hyperventilated and cried to his mother about going to hell. And his mother embraced him and calmed him down and said, "I'm going to give you the secret tomorrow to how to avoid the eight hot hells." And so just now, just sleep. So the next day, gets up, and his mother tells him, "What you have to do is worship at a Buddhist shrine to Tenjin and chant." This involves a lot of chanting, this worship. So Hakuin did that. He became a Tenjin devotee. And then a little while after that, He's horsing around with his brother. And his brother has kind of a painting, almost like, you know, you'd have posters in your wall, in your room, of somebody or other, somebody you like. His brother had some samurai there. And Hakone was fooling around with arrows and shot this guy in the eye. And he was so worried about what was going to happen to him once he was discovered. And so he prayed to Tenjin to keep it a secret. Well, it didn't work. Immediately he got found out. And his mother was angry. His father was very angry. His mother was, and his brother, of course. His mother was disappointed, but didn't scold him. And so he told his mother, "I'm not. This doesn't work with Tenjin. If he couldn't save me from that, how can he save me from the hothouse?" So he moves on to Kuan Yin and Kuan Yin practice. I think his mother suggests that. And moves on from Kuan Yin to Zen practice and enters the monastery. But this idea, I guess one of the things that I take from his life is that Hakone was an experimenter. He ran experiments. He'd have a hypothesis, he'd try it, and then he'd see how it worked out. He had this great awakening experience at 24 years old. He practiced very hard, very energetically, as Wes said. And he heard the sound of a bell and had a great insight into the reality of things. And he was sure it was the greatest awakening in the last 300 years. And that's what he went around talking about. This was the greatest awakening for a long, long time. But he noticed after a few months it wore off. And in particular, he couldn't find a tranquil mind in daily life. So he went back to practice. He kind of, with his tail between his legs. Again, another example. He was honest, he could have faked it, right? But he didn't. So he practiced day and night. He went through a period of Zen sickness, which I won't go into now, but it's kind of a famous period in his life, where he basically had a nervous breakdown and then found a Taoist hermit to help him. He tried his Zen people, and they couldn't help him. So he went out and found a Taoist. Again, very Hakone move to help him and to fix him. And they had a Taoist in Japan. So at 42, he had his great awakening, which was reading the Lotus Sutra, which before he had ridiculed. Yeah, that was his mother's sacred text. And his great realization was that Bodhi mind is means to help other people. He stressed having an active practice, honest and curious, and incorporating it into your everyday life. He was raised poor, and he stayed close to his roots. He didn't move to the monastery even after he became famous. And he went back to his old temple, and everybody came to him, and the countryside around him was overrun with practitioners using all the old buildings they could find. And he loved not just talking to monks and nuns, but also to commoners and to people in the countryside, and he drew from Confucianism, Taoism, other Japanese traditions to teach them. And this song, the Song of Zazen, is meant for common people. I read one text saying, "It's so funny that it's that it's chanted in monasteries now, you know, in the States, because it's really meant for just common folk. But it's beautiful that way. It's a simple song to our foundational practice, which is Zazen, meditation. The first four lines go like this. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. So the first one there, all beings by nature are Buddha. You and everybody else is fundamentally a Buddha. Another way to put that is you have Buddha nature, this thing that we talk about in Zen. You have Buddha nature. When I started my practice at Mount Baldy Zen Center, the head monk read me something on behalf of the teacher, the Roshi, that went like this, and I remember it pretty well because I don't have that text anymore, but when I was a head monk, I read it to new students. Please begin your practice with the faith that you have Buddha nature and that you share that nature with every flower, bird, and and tree. And if you were to meet God and the devil, they would also share the Buddha nature with you. So it was a funny thing, you know, to be asked right at the beginning of your Zen practice to take something on faith. But I was asked to do that in that initial meeting. Have faith that you have another nature, that you have another aspect besides yourself. And what does that mean? You have a quiet and calm aspect that is without a personal self. And I think what Hakuin is saying here is that, even further, is that you and I are fundamentally without a self, and that we can realize that. But the only way to realize that in Zen is to give up temporarily that personal self. And that's what we do in this practice of Zazen. We give up our concerns, we give up all of our thoughts about ourself and the world. We give all of that up. So it's in my training, I was asked not only to take it on faith, but then to realize it, to realize what that means to have Buddha nature. And that's what we do over and over again in Zen practice, is to realize that by dropping our personal self. And then to realize that not only do I have Buddha nature, but everything, even God and the devil, have Buddha nature. I was taught that everything has a self. An ant has an ant self, a dog has a dog self. We have our personal selves, humans have human selves. And we have cultures, you know, all of those different, tree has tree culture. But the tree also has a Buddha nature, has this quiet, still, not wanting to be anything else nature. The tree has kind of an active nature and also a passive nature. And that zero self of the tree is the same zero self that I have, the dog has, the cat has. And some traditions say after the Buddha was enlightened that his first words were, all beings are already enlightened, they just don't see it. That's the same thing. It's we all have this nature. We just don't see it. We just don't. And our job is to see it, to realize it. And the second line there, Hakuin says, all beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. I love that image. Stephen gave some talk. Do you remember that? Gave a talk ages ago about, or led a discussion or something about, I wasn't here, sorry.
Water metaphors
in Buddhism. And, you know, Hakuin says, okay, so you, this Buddha nature is your fundamental self, just like water is the fundamental aspect of ice. And I think he chooses that metaphor intentionally and well, because myself is fixed and solid. I have these views, I have these opinions, you know, I have this shape, and I know what shape that is. So we're fixed as human beings, like ice. And Buddhism says, though you may not remember it, you were originally water. That block of ice doesn't know that it was originally water most of the time. And our practice is to feel what it's like to melt, to become water, to become more fluid. You know, when we're sitting and we're not thinking about our life, we're not reflecting on who we are and what our agenda is and what our current situation is, then we loosen and we become available to this moment. We take in whatever's happening, whether it's a sound we like or a sound we don't like. In that way, we act like water. I think about the ocean in this respect. You know, the ocean just surrounds and accepts everything in it, no matter what it is, and anything you put in it, it just surrounds and accepts. And this, there's a metaphor that's sometimes used in Zen, which is the wave in the water. You and I were waves, with a beginning and an end and a shape and a character, but we're also water. We're also the ocean at the same time as we have that shape. And there's a nice line from Suzuki Roshi. He says, he compares our minds, our thinking selves, to the wave. Even though the wave arises, the essence of your mind is pure. It's like clear water. He says, waves are the practice of water. To speak of waves apart from water, or water apart from waves, is a delusion. Water and waves are one. When you understand your mind this way, you have some security in your feeling. And, when we can feel our water aspect more readily, I think it changes something in our life. We have to have a shape, you know, we have to, that's important, to understand ourselves. We have a self. But adding to that a knowledge of water, that we're water, and adding to that the practice of melting, makes us more flexible and open. We just have to keep practicing it. And then when we run into something difficult in our lives, an obstacle, there's a better chance that we don't ice up, that we can more fluidly accept that situation and see things differently. Water sees things differently than ice does. It sees around objects and obstacles. It sees it from different perspectives. It sees other possibilities. So I love that second line, as ice by nature is water. I'll just quickly go through these next couple of lines here. Apart from water, there is no ice. So he says they are, just like Suzuki Roshi says, they are one. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, there is no Buddha. Just to tease those apart, apart from water, there is no ice. There is, another way to say that is, there is no ice that is not water. So, according to our tradition, everything, every sentient being has this Buddha nature, whether it be a bird or a dog or a flower, this quiet, flowing aspect. And then the next one, apart from beings, no Buddha. This one's a little bit different. This, by the way, is the same form as form is emptiness, emptiness is form. They're completely together. And apart from beings, no Buddha, that says to me that there is no Buddha nature floating out there in space. There is no great God of Buddha nature. Even though Buddha represents Buddha nature, it's not something that is separate from any being. There's no separate mystical force in Zen. It's only an aspect of our being. So there is no Buddha that's outside of beings. Well, I hope you see your life as an experiment, and also your practice as an experiment. That you, like Hakuin did, take hypotheses and then try them. And the same is true in our practice. There is this hypothesis. You are Buddha. You have Buddha nature. What does that mean? How do you manifest that? Is it true? Hakuin asks us to start with a hypothesis and then work honestly with it. I'd ask you to work honestly in your practice, in your zazen, to see what happens when you lose yourself. See what comes up. Really discover, if you can, what the Zen tradition promises there is there, which is this original water aspect, this original Buddha nature.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.